Good afternoon. I would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to our Lyceum program. This afternoon's guest speaker is Maya Angelou. Author, historian, and playwright are just a few of many descriptive titles which are associated with Ms. Angelou. She has had 5 bestsellers, including her 2 autobiographies, one entitled I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and the other entitled Gather Together in My Name. At the conclusion of this afternoon's Lyceum, Ms. Angelou has graciously consented to a brief autographing session to take place in our bookstore. Would you now join me in giving a warm welcome to Ms. Maya Angelou? Thank you.
Thank you very much. She does not know her beauty. She thinks her brown body has no glory. If she could dance naked under palm trees and see her image in the river, she would know. But there are no palm trees on the street, and dishwater gives back no images. That is a poem by Mr. Waring Cooney, a black male poet writing in the 30s, a perfect piece of poetry as far as lyricism and loveliness goes. More importantly, it shows what happens to a person or to persons who are lacking in a senses of self-worth. I say the poem again. She does not know her beauty. She thinks her brown body has no glory. If she could dance naked under palm trees and see her image in the river, she would know. But there are no palm trees on the street, and dishwater gives back no images. I'm asked to speak about the role of black women in today's world. It is impossible to talk about black women in today's world or any world without speaking of black men. And if I'm speaking of black Americans, it's impossible to speak about black Americans without speaking about white Americans and Native Americans and Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans and Aleuts. Don't forget the Aleuts. It is impossible, for although we know that this is our country, it is these yet-to-be United States, we do impact and interact upon each other and with each other, willingly or unwillingly. I think in order to speak about the black American female, I must speak about the survival of a people. And I hope that while I speak through the black experience, because that's what I know, it will be understood that I'm talking about the human condition, exactly how it is with human beings, what makes us weep, what makes us laugh, what we overcome, what sometimes does us down. There's a statement by Terence. The statement was made in 154 BC. The statement is, "Homo sum, humane nihil a me alienum puto." I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me. Wonderful statement. Interesting about Terence, too. When you look in your encyclopedia, under Terence with one R, you'll find that his Latin name is Terentius Afer, or Terence of Africa. He was a slave sold to a Roman senator. He was freed by that senator and became the most popular playwright in Rome. And this man, not born white, not born a citizen, not born free, said, "I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me." Now, if you can take that, all of you take that and internalize it, put it somewhere behind the kneecap, we will go on and talk directly about black American women. generally, we're talking about the human spirit. And love. Love. You know, many people think that love is mush, sentimentality, indulgence, etc. Love is powerful at its best. Love is that connective link. It is that adhesion which holds the spirit together, which causes an entire species to survive nobly. I don't mean just to go from day to day. There are many kinds of love. There is erotic love. There is agape love, familial love, self-love, and many others that maybe you will tell me about later on. In erotic love, first I better tell you why I'm going to use poetry to look at love, all these aspects of it. Poetry is asked to be magical, mystical, lyrical, and musical. And unfortunately, when we look at black poetry, many people are not aware of the great beauty, the legacy of black poetry. How beautiful, how strong, how noble, or how lyrical it is. Twain said in 1906, if you will have a person enslaved, the first thing you must do is convince yourself that the person is subhuman. The second thing you must do is convince your allies that the person is subhuman. But the third and the unkindest cut of all is to convince that person that he or she is subhuman. A qualitative job has been done on the black American and the white American vis-a-vis the black American, so that the black American poetry is not heralded with the same respect that the white American poetry is. But listen to this line. There's a blues, 19th century blues, which says, if you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. And if you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been. That's poetry. There's a spiritual which says, green trees are bending, poor sinner stands a trembling. Now, of course, you could say, it was in the early spring, and there was a cold wind coming out of Canada, and someone who hadn't done the right thing, feeling guilty and remorseful, was standing over by some trees shaking as a consequence. Or you could simply say it poetically. Green trees are bending, poor sinner stands a trembling. There's a blues which says, he's blacker than midnight, teeth like flags of truth. He's the sweetest thing in the whole St. Louis. They say the blacker the berry, sweeter is the juice. Poetry. Now, so I will use poetry to talk about love. Many non-blacks, when they write about blacks and erotic love, would have us believe that white people make love and black people just have sex. Cold. However, Miss Georgia Johnson, a 19th century black lady poet, wrote, I want to die while you love me, while yet you hold me fair, while laughter lies upon my lips and lights are in my hair. Yes. I want to die while you love me. Who would care to live till love had nothing more to ask and nothing more to give? No. I want to die while you love me and bear to that still bed your kisses, turbulent, unspent, to warm me while I'm dead. Mr. James Weldon Johnson wrote, 1906, seemed like to me the sun don't shine so bright. Seemed like to me the moon done lost its light. Seemed like to me that nothing's going right since you went away. It seemed like to me the days are just twice as long. It seemed like to me the birds done lost their song. It seemed like to me that everything is wrong since you went away. Seems like to me I just can't help but sigh. Seems like to me my throat keeps getting dry. Seems like to me a tear stay in my eyes since you went away. And Mr. Paul Laurence Dunbar, writing in 1896, wrote a love song, love poem called A Negro Love Song, which could have been written by a newly liberated woman last week. Seen my lady home last night, jump back, honey, jump back. Held her hand and squeezed it tight, jump back, honey, jump back. I heard her sigh, a little sigh, and I saw that light gleam in her eye. Saw a smile go flitting by, say, jump back, honey, jump back. The mockingbird was singing fine, jump back, honey, jump back. And my heart was beating so that when I reached my lady's door, I just couldn't bear to go. I said, jump back, honey, jump back. So I put my arm around her waist, jump back, honey, jump back. I raised her lips and took a taste, jump back, honey, jump back. I said, love me, honey, you love me true. You love me well as I love you. And then she answered, of course I do, but jump back, honey, jump back. In Miss Marie Evans, a lovely poet, wrote, where have you gone with your confident walk, your crooked smile? Why did you leave me? When you left, you took your laughter and departed, are you aware that with you went the sun, all light, and what few stars there were? Where have you gone with your confident walk, with your crooked smile, the rent money in one pocket and my heart in the other? There's a poem by Miss Nikki Giovanni, staying on the theme of erotic love. One of these days, you're going to walk in this house, and I'm going to be wearing my long African gown. And you, not noticing me at all, will say, the trouble in this country, and I'll be taking the gown off. And you will say, I wonder about this brother, and I'll be licking your arm. And you will say, what we ought to do, and I'll be taking your pants off. I want to talk about what we need, and I'll be taking your shorts off. And then you, finally noticing your state of undress, will turn to me and say, Nikki, isn't this counter-revolutionary? They went home and told their wives that never once in all their lives had they met a girl like me. But they went home. My praises were on all men's lips. They liked my smile, my wit, my hips. They'd spend one night or two or three, but they went home. They said my house was licking clean and nothing I said was ever mean, and I had an air of mystery. But now, I wrote that years ago for young women who have very high moral standards, very high, in their teens and 20s, who, if you overhear them, if you eavesdrop, you can hear them saying things like, married men, me? Oh, no, dear. Mm-mm, don't waste my time. No way. But if they continue to live and the 30s come and the living room is empty, and the foyer is empty, and the kitchen is empty, and their hearts are lonely, and other parts of their houses are uninhabited. Sometimes the morals dip, and they find themselves in that very situation, which they had sworn would never catch them, in which they'd never be caught. I wondered after writing it what the men, what made men treat women's hearts so cavalierly. And gentlemen, I'm probably wrong, but I did write a poem about it. And I know I'm wrong, so don't hold it against me. I ask for your tolerance in advance, because I know I'm wrong, all right? This is the men's point of view, I think. There's a long-legged girl in San Francisco by the Golden Gate. She said she'd give me all I wanted, but I just couldn't wait. I started to picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, getting to the next town, baby. Now, picking them up and laying them down, in Arkansas, in my little town, the town in which I grew up, that was a phrase meant to indicate moving out of town. Picking up one foot and laying the other down, picking it up and laying it down. And I mean that, but in this poem, I mean a little more than that. There's a pretty brown in Birmingham. Man, she's little and cute. But when she tried to tie me down, I had to grab my suit and start to picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down and getting to the next town, baby. When I met that lovely Detroit lady, I thought my time had come. But just before I said, I do. I said, I got to run and started to picking them up and laying them down and picking them up and laying them down and picking them up and laying them down, getting to the next town, baby. Now, there ain't no words for what I feel about a pretty face. But if I stay, I just might miss a prettier one someplace. That's why I start that picking them up and laying them down and picking them up and laying them down. Gentlemen, I know I'm wrong. In the series of love poems, erotic love poems, it is, I must do one that, is written on a cultural carryover. There's a carryover current in Black American life called signifying. It is from Africa, in the areas of West Africa from which most of our people were taken, Black Americans' people, ancestors were taken, it is still against the law to call a person a fool. You can go to jail on the charge of assault with the tongue. However, since people often are foolish and it's impossible to resist telling them, West Africans devised ways in which to inform the offender of his or her offense without coming directly out and saying so. So we call it signifying. It is very dangerous. You can get dead if you do it wrong. I know no whites and very few blacks who really successfully signify, because you must be witty. You must be able to make a person laugh, the very offender laugh, while he or she knows he or she is the object of your probe. I hate to lose something. Then she bent her head. Even a dime, I wish I was dead. I can't explain it no more to be said, except I hate to lose something. I lost a doll once and cried for a week. She could open her eyes and do all but speak. I believe she was took by some doll snatching sneak. I tell you, I hate to lose something. A watch of mine once got up and walked away. It had 12 numbers on it for the time of day. I can't explain it, nothing to say except I hate to lose something. Now, if I felt that way about a watch and a toy, what you think I feel about my lover boy? I ain't threatening you, madam, but he is my evening's joy, and I really hate to lose something. Miss Ann Spencer, another black lady poet writing, born in the 19th century, wrote a love poem to her sister and all sisters. It is dangerous for a woman to defy the gods, to taunt them with the tongue's thin tip, or strut in the weakness of mere humanity, or draw a line, daring them to cross. The gods own the searing lightning, the drowning waters, tormenting fears, and the anger of red sins. Oh, but worse still, if you mince timidly, dodge this way or that, or kneel or pray, be kind or sweat agony drops, or lay your quick body over your feeble young. If you have beauty or none, celibate or vowed, the gods are Huguenot, passing over, over. This you may do, my dear. Lock your heart then quietly, and lest they peer within, light no lamp when sun comes down. Raise no shade for sun. Breathless must your breath come through if you dare die and deny the gods their godlike fun. Miss Ann Spencer. She's one of the, well, among the great poets in English. Miss Marie Evans, a poem on self-love. I am a black woman. The music of my song, some sweet arpeggio of tears, is written in a minor key, and I can be heard humming in the night, humming in the night. I saw my mate leap screaming into the sea, and I, with these hands, cup the life breath from my issue in the cane break. I lost Nat's swinging body in a rain of tears, and heard my son scream all the way from Anzio for a peace he never knew. I learned Da Nang and Pork Chop Hill in anguish. Now my nostrils know the gas, and these trigger-tired fingers seek the softness in my warrior's beard. I am a black woman, tall as a cypress, strong beyond all definition, still defying place and time and circumstance, assailed, impervious, indestructible. Look upon me and be renewed. What a lovely poem. Won't you applaud Miss Marie Evans? That's an encouraging poem. That poem is an inspiration to the human spirit. Those are some of the kinds of love. There is, of course, the love between generations. And I love that love, personally. I believe that human beings live in direct relation to the heroes and sheroes we have, always and in all ways. For centuries, our people were obliged to laugh when they weren't tickled and to scratch when they didn't itch. And those gestures have come down to us as Uncle Tommy. However, I don't think we often enough stop, as black people or whites or Asians or Hispanics or Native Americans, stop to wonder how that black man's throat must have been aching on that terrible, constricting ache. When he said, yes, the boss, you're right, I show stupid. So he could make enough money so he could come home and feed you. Or that black woman who said, no, ma'am, Miss Ann, you didn't hurt me when you slapped me. No, ma'am, I ain't tenderhearted. So she could make enough money so she could come home and feed me. And obviously they were successful. or I wouldn't be here to talk to you, some of you who wouldn't be here to listen to me. In direct relation to the heroes and sheroes we have, we stay alive. So that love, that sacrifice, that living on the ledge of death to keep a race alive is an honorable, noble, and very generous gesture. There's a woman who rides a bus in New York City. She's on the 8th Avenue bus. If she's a maid, she has two shopping bags, black woman. If the bus stops too fast, she goes, ah, ha, 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 ha. If it stops too slowly, if it picks up someone, if it misses them. I watched that woman for almost 9 months. And I thought, you know, if you don't know black features, you'll think she's laughing. She's not laughing. Nothing's happening to her eyes. She's simply extending her lips and making a sound. So I realized what she was doing was utilizing her survival apparatus. And I wrote a poem for her. When I think about myself, I almost laugh myself to death. My life has been one great big joke. A dance was walked, a song was spoke. I laughed so hard, I nearly choke when I think about myself. 60 years in these folks' world, the child I works for calls me girl. I say, yes, ma'am, for working's sake. I'm too proud to bend and too poor to break, so I laugh until my stomach ache when I think about myself. And my folks can make me split my side. I laugh so hard I nearly died. The tales they tell sound just like lying. They grow the fruit but eat the rind. I laugh. Until I start to cry when I think about myself. The children in that wonderful love, the love of children, of course, is imperative because the children are our tomorrows. They will give us the tomorrows. Given the ordinary set of circumstances and time, the small people, many of you, will take us into the 21st century. So I often write poems for children, for and about children. And there's a poem called Harlem Hopscotch. Now, hopscotch, wherever it's jumped, is dun, dun, jump, dun, dun, jump, dun, dun, jump. I mean, it's always the same. In Sweden, it's called hoppa hoga. In Japan, it's jump, dun, dun, jump. However, in Harlem, Harlem, New York, Harlem, Houston, Harlem, Oklahoma City, Harlem, San Francisco. That's the basic rhythm, yes, dun, dun, jump. But it becomes polyrhythmic. The game becomes polyrhythmic, laid over with other rhythms. It becomes dun, dun, chuk-a-dun, dun, 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 and so forth. Then what the children are thinking as they jump hopscotch in Harlem are other thoughts than those thoughts thought by the children who jump hopscotch on Park Avenue. Park Avenue, New York, Park Avenue, Houston, Park Avenue, Los Angeles. So I wrote Harlem Hopscotch. 1 foot down, then hop, it's hot. Good things for the ones that's got. Another jump, now to the left. Everybody for himself. In the air, now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone, rent is due. Cuss and cry, and then jump too. Everybody's out of work. Hold for three, and then twist and jerk. cross the line, they count you out, but that's what hopping's all about. Both feet down, the game is done. They think you lost. I believe you won. Back to that love of the old folks. some years ago, I was with an opera company. And I was the premier danseuse with the company. We had traveled through Europe. The company went on, we went to Israel, to Egypt, and then to Morocco. The company sent the sets on to Spain, and we were told by the conductor that we were obliged to perform in a concert. Well, among 63 people, there were 140 degrees in music. There were so few places for black singers trained in European classics. And I use that advisedly, that those two words together, because I know classical music in the United States must include blues, spirituals, etc. So, but those people trained in European classical music, if they were black, had so few vehicles, so few places to work, the company could afford to get a person who had one degree from Curtis and another from Juilliard just to be in the chorus. So there they were, opera singers, marvelous opera singers, Porgy and Bess, great singers. And when the conductor told the company, announced that we had to do concerts, they were ready. Now, opera singers, whether they are black or white, Asian, Hispanic, or Native American, or Serbo-Croat, or Burmese, or one tribe, like New York taxi drivers, they are a people, you understand? They were ready to sing with their aria. I think they had them all on microfilm taped behind their watches or something. They were all ready. But I was a dancer, so I said to the conductor, I'm sorry, this is not my discipline. I'm just not ready. I don't have any arias. I sang a role in Porgy and Bess, but I learned it by heart, by ear. I wasn't trained. And he turned to me. He was Russian, with great Russian hair boiling all over his head. And I think every morning he must have heated up his artistic temperament in a samovar. He turned to me and said, "Bart, don't you know it's spiritual?" And I thought, is Grits Groceries? You ask me if I know a spiritual? I grew up in Arkansas in a place about the size of this side of this auditorium. And we went to church on Sunday. I don't mean we went to church on Sunday and left. I mean we went to church all day Sunday, right? Then Monday night was usher board meeting. Tuesday night was prayer meeting. Wednesday night was choir practice and so forth. Every night we went to church, except Saturday. We didn't go to church on Saturday. We used Saturday to prepare to go to church on Sunday. And at all these gatherings, we sang. So I knew every Long Meter hymn, every Dr. Watts, every gospel song, all the songs. So I told him, yes, I know a spiritual. Well, the singers went out, and they delivered themselves of lovely, Lord Onimobile, beautifully, and Un Bel Di, Respighi, Rossini, and Haydn, and lovely little pieces by Purcell, and oh, just beautiful things. And then I went, and they were well received. Then I went out onto the stage, and there was a 120-piece orchestra in the pit, but how could they help me with their viola and cello? I said, lay out, it's all right. I'll shoot my best shot. So I thought of a song that my grandmother used to sing every Sunday in the church in which I grew up. She was the mother of the church, and every Sunday, 15 minutes after the service began, the minister would look over in the mother of the church pew and say, and now we'll be led in a hymn by Sister Henderson. And every Sunday, my grandmother went, me? And you know, no one can embarrass you as much as your parents or anyone to whom you're connected. When you're young, I used to sit in the children's pew and just think, Mama, get up and sing. Everybody knows you're going to sing. They know what you're going to sing. Mama, just get up. And but she would take her time. She'd put her pocketbook down. She'd spread her handkerchief on her lap and press it, then fold it and press it. And it looks like to me that took 20 minutes. And the kids would be giggling in the children's pew and nudging and looking at me. But finally, she would stand and she'd sing a cappella. And in Morocco, on the stage alone, I sang, I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone. No hope have I for tomorrow. I've started to make heaven my home. My mother, she's found her sweet glory. My father's still living in sin. And my brothers and sisters won't own me. Because I am trying to get in. Well, I want you to know I sang the whole song through. When I finished, 4,500 Arabs jumped up and started stomping. Wallahi lazim, wallahi lazim, wallahi. I was very young. Not just chronologically. I was very young. I didn't know about that great abiding love. So I stood and shivered, and the people just stomped and stomped. And I looked stage right and stage left in the wings, and there were the bel canto singers. There were the people from Curtis and Juilliard. There were the concert singers looking at me with such jealousy. And I, not knowing what I had, looked at them apologetically. Sorry. Beg your pardon. Sorry to have taken the glory. I walked through the singers, you know, huddled in the wings, and really, literally said, well, I don't know what happened. And skedaddled out. And I walked in the streets of Morocco and wondered to myself, what was that? Exactly what was that? What caused those people to respond to me so? And it finally came to me that during the 19th century, when the Declaration of Independence was being written, was written and was signed, for the most part, my people were illiterate. When this country was cut up and shared among the whites, and great names came out of the sharing and the taking of a land, great names came out of the fishing in the waters and the finding of the gold and the mining and the taking of the otters. My people, for the most part, were not only illiterate, but terribly poor, enslaved and in chains. And yet, look what they gave me. Look. A legacy so real that it will not indulge the distance of continents, centuries, oceans, languages, genders, none of that. A part of the human condition. An amazing record. A great record. Great poetry. Great music. And it opens doors for me all over the world. And it belongs, interestingly enough, it belongs to everybody. That is love. Thank you. I want to read you one last poem of Mr. Oh, I hope it's here. Yes. This is a small poem, that is, well, no poem is small unless it really is a small poem, but this one is James Weldon Johnson's poem to those who wrote that music. Oh, black and unknown bards of long ago, how came your lips to touch the sacred fire? How, in your darkness, did you come to know the power and beauty of the minstrel's lyre? Who first, from midst his bonds, lifted his eyes? Who first, from out the still watch, lone and long, feeling the ancient faith of prophets rise within his long-kept soul, burst into song? Heart of what slave poured out such melody as "Steal Away"? On its strains, his spirit must have nightly floated free, though still about his hands he felt his chains. And who heard first great Jordan roll? Whose starward eye saw chariots swing low? And who was he that breathed that comforting melodic sigh? Nobody knows the trouble I see. There is a wide, wide wonder in it all, that from degraded rest and servile toil, the fiery spirit of the seer should call these people of the sun and soil. Old black slave singers gone, forgot, unfamed, you alone of all the long, long line of those who have sung, untaught, unknown, unnamed, have stretched out upward, seeking the divine. Mr. James Weldon Johnson. In looking at self-love and self-appreciation, which is necessary, you know, for all of us, we have to, in truth, develop it within ourselves before we can trust that we're capable of caring for anyone else. It is imperative that you have an appreciation of yourself. And then you can, with some security, say, "I care for you." But there's an African statement which is, "Be careful when a naked person offers you a piece of cloth." If you don't care for yourself, Jack, you're in trouble trying to talk about you care for someone else. Among black Americans, we have a saying, which is "stay black and beautiful." And obviously, it is not just the color of skin that one is encouraging the listener to maintain or retain, since in color, we range from milk white to plum blue. So obviously, there's something else in that exhortation. And the something else is survive and do better than that. Thrive and do better than that. Thrive with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style. That's to stay black and beautiful. In those colors, for a long time, we called ourselves bouquets of roses, gardens of flowers. And I'm afraid that today a number of young black people are losing the names that we have called ourselves for centuries to describe the color. So there's a poem I'm going to recite, give you, remind you. And I would like you to make notes, please, so you can go and find the poem on your own. It's a poem by Langston Hughes, and it's called Harlem Sweeties. I have a sister friend who is white. We have known each other 30 years. We were poor and young together. And she was raising a daughter. I was raising a son. If her son, if her daughter, rather, needed to have her teeth fixed, which seemed to be every week she got a new cavity. I guess we didn't have television at the time to tell us how to prevent that. Then I would give her $6, which is what it cost at the time, to have, I know it's that long ago, to have her daughter's teeth fixed. My son lost his glasses every week, so I'd take her $8 to get his glasses.